We will do a public hearing on House Bill, correction, Senate Bill 1093.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Steve Statham, General Counsel for Oregon Health Sciences University. Pleased to have the opportunity to come before you. 4 years ago, the legislature and OHSU embarked on an innovative effort to place OHSU in a position to continue its ascent among the top ranks of academic health centers in the country by passing Senate Bill 2 in 1995, which created OHSU as a public corporation, still a governmental entity, but separate from the state system of higher education for most purposes. The bill that we're here before today on, Senate Bill 1093, is merely a housekeeping measure designed to clarify some ambiguities and fix some technical problems that have come to light since we've been acting as a public corporation in the last 4 years working under Senate Bill 2. Most of Senate Bill 2 was codified in Chapter 353, so when you're looking at Senate Bill 1093 and see a lot of references to 353, that's the reason. Although we think this is really a technical housekeeping measure, there are some provisions that may be of more interest than others, and so what I'd like to do is briefly cover a few of the key points of the bill, and then if there are questions about those key points or any other portions of the bill, I'd be glad to answer those. Several of the provisions are merely, as I say, technical fixes. An example of that would be in Section 3 of Senate Bill 1093, there's a clarification that no OHSU employee except the president of OHSU can be a voting member of the Board of Directors. Right now, the statute says that no employee can be a member of the Board of Directors, but another provision of the statute says the president is to be on the board, and so we're just trying to clarify that inconsistency. Another piece of the legislation that you may be of interested in is Section 18, which amends our enabling legislation concerning our care, custody, and control of the real property comprising our campus. In the original bill, the bill provided that OHSU would have care, custody, and control of the real property, that was understood by everybody to mean that, in effect, we would have a long-term ground lease, but the legislation wasn't really clear on this point. We went to the public markets for bond financing in the fall of 1995. They asked us what our rights in real property were, and we said, well, we have care, custody, control. And we said, what does that mean? And they said, well, effectively, it means a ground lease. And they said, well, we'd like a ground lease then. So we went to the state, and the State Board of Higher Education, the Attorney General's office, worked with us, and we executed a ground lease. But there was some uncertainty at the time about whether or not the State Board of Higher Education or a state agency was authorized to sign a ground lease for the property. So we went ahead and worked that out with the help of the Attorney General's office and the higher ed people, but we are going back with this bill to try and clarify that that is in fact authorized, and the bill provides for the Department of Administrative Services to be the agency to sign the ground lease. The other thing we did is, at the time, because there was some uncertainty about what care, custody, and control meant in terms of a ground lease, we signed a 50-year ground lease. This bill changes that to 99 years with an automatic renewal feature to it. This will help us in the future when we go to the public markets, because most bond issues are of 20, 25, 30-year duration like mortgages, and when you try to refinance or refund them, there needs to be some significant amount of time for the refunding obligation, so that there's no concern in the public markets that the real estate will not be there to continue to produce the revenues to pay off the bonds if they're ever refunded. So that is Section 18. Another section that might be of interest is Section 21, which adds an exemption from the disclosure requirements of ORS 192501 to allow us to protect the identity of those who wish to make donations or on a confidential or anonymous basis to the university, which we, of course, want to encourage. So, Section 25 adds an exemption to the open meetings law for meetings of the OHSU Board of Directors or Board Committees regarding sensitive business, financial, or commercial matters that are not customarily provided to competitors. And this is in three categories. The original language was to match the language from the public records law, which already contains an exemption of that nature. This is narrower than that. This exemption is for sensitive business, financial, or commercial matters in three categories: financings, mergers, acquisitions, and joint ventures being one category, sale or disposition or substantial change in or use of significant real or personal property being in a second category, and health system strategies being in a third category. So those are the, I would say, the key points of any substance in the bill before you, but I'd be glad to answer questions because there are other technical matters that are being addressed in the bill as well.
Representative Morissette.
Thank you. Could you explain the health system strategy part of the open meeting?
Sure. I'd be glad to. Currently, the university is subject to the open meetings law as a public entity. However, our missions, which are both public and somewhat private in nature, include providing a health care system, and the original purpose of Senate Bill 2 in large part was to give us greater flexibility so that we could survive and thrive in the environment that we're in, which is very competitive. The purpose of the exemption for health system strategies is to enable our board to meet and get the information and share the information about strategic matters that affect the healthcare part of our mission and the healthcare part of our operations, so that we're on both an equal footing with some of our competitors, but also just are able to more effectively utilize the resources of the board. Currently, we're not able to have those kinds of discussions unless we are having them in an open meeting or on a one-on-one basis, and it's harder to get kind of dialogue and interchange of information and ideas with our board under the current arrangement. So that's the purpose of the exemption.
Section 26 describes the authority of the president of the university to sale or disposition of the properties. Do you have properties that are not on land lease?
Yes. We, in 1998, merged with the Oregon Regional Primate Research Center, which is out in the what we call our West Campus in the Hillsborough area. And that property was not part of the state's real property when Senate Bill 2 was passed. So that property we have actual title to, although it's subject to a number of restrictions from our research funding, the National Institutes of Health.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Starr.
A follow-up on your comment. Do you have OHSU who have plans of selling the Primate Center?
No. We do have some plans. We have a long-term master plan out there that the City of Hillsborough worked with us on. We do have some plans to further develop it.
Okay.
Right now, we have, in fact, a construction project in the works to expand some of our research facilities out there. So we do not have any of those plans.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so what you're talking about is acquisition of an additional properties in Villa to do the necessary real estate transactions.
That's probably the most likely scenario, although it could be a situation where we might want to do an exchange of a parcel that might be part of the West Campus or even the main campus. Of course, with the main campus, since it's subject to a long-term lease, any title transfer would require the state's approval. But there could be parcels involved that we would maybe want to do a land swap on or something like that. But primarily, I think we'd be talking about future acquisitions of property.
Just further follow up, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, then you intend to maintain the presence in your Hillsborough campus then?
Yes.
Outstanding. Yep. Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll move into a work session on Senate Bill 1093.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Starr.
I move Senate Bill 1093. 93 to the House floor. I do pass recommendation.
Representative Starr moves Senate Bill 1093 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
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 Both aye. Stop it. Senator Starr, declare that. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1093 and go into a public hearing on Senate Bill 367. Might as well bring 487 back as well.
No, he meant just
Greg and Jim Green.
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Greg McMurdo from the Department of Education. You've heard this bill, and my purpose in being here is to see if there are any questions. I know that I understand that you may have some amendments from the Reagan School Employees Association, and I'd be happy to, I haven't seen the amendments, but I'd be happy to speak to those if there's any interest.
Do we have amendments?
Yeah. We just got them.
Why don't we pass them out, and Greg, you can address them if you like.
It would help, Mr. Chair. I can go through the record or the history of fingerprinting. It's had kind of a long and varied history, and I had indeed had to go through myself because I couldn't remember exactly when everything occurred. And during the 1993 session, Representative Courtney and others introduced the first bill, and that was at the time considered a rather ambitious bill in that it required all existing employees and newly hired employees of school districts, including teachers and non-teachers, to be fingerprinted and for those records to be run through an FBI criminal background history check. That bill was amended solely because of the fiscal impact to include only newly hired employees. So existing employees were not covered in the 1993 Act. In the 1995 session, there were several amendments that were introduced. The most significant amendment was to do a number of things. There was a definition change in ORS 330.003 that was introduced at the request of the department that picked up the schools that we covered under the original law because our schools are not considered school districts. So we asked for a definition amendment that would include in the definition of school districts the Oregon School for the Deaf, the Oregon School for the Blind, and the juvenile training facilities. In addition, and that was House Bill 2123, in addition to that, in House Bill 2236, there was a reference correction made due to an error on the part of legislative counsel in codification. What that reference did was leave out a reference to classified employees for purposes of collecting the fees to run the fingerprint program. And I should point out this program has, since inception, been designed to be self-supporting, in other words, a fee-based program. There was also a bill introduced that session, Senate Bill 262, that whose purpose was to consolidate the education districts in the state. It was the reorganization of education service districts. That bill passed and was signed into law after the definition change that we had requested. Legislative Council changed the definition again of school district in ORS 330.003 to include not all, to exclude education service districts that did not levy taxes for their component districts, what we call equalization education service districts. So there was a conflict between two bills. The conflict was not caught by anyone, and the latter enacted bill was the contained the definition of school district that was more restrictive than the bill that was passed prior to that. In the last session of the legislature, there were a number of bills again added to, or a number of bills dealing with fingerprinting. I think the relevant bills, one was Senate Bill 956, which I believe you were involved in, that added private schools to the fingerprint, the possibility of fingerprinting its employees. Another bill called for the printing of all existing employees, and the statutory scheme that was set up called for the employees to be printed on two different series or two different schemes. If they were teachers, then when their licenses came up for renewal, they were to be fingerprinted and processed. If they were existing classified employees, depending on their birth month, they were required to be processed on certain dates. That brings us, and one of the things we should mention is that one of the issues during these sessions that the department was not particularly involved in, but it was a heated issue, was who's going to pay for this? Who's going to pay for the printing, which for classified employees is, I believe, $42. And I think the legislature wisely decided that they would leave that up to school districts to bargain, and that all employees, both licensed and classified employees, should be treated the same. In other words, we were going to have that a bargaining issue for one group, it should be a bargaining issue for all. So that brings us to the present bill. I think as I testified when the bill was first heard, it was after the beginning of this session that it was brought to our attention that the 1995 amendment, second amendment to ORS 330.003 changed the definition of school district to exclude most education service districts. That was brought to our attention after the deadline for us to file a bill, and the only thing I could do was to seek an amendment, which we did to one of the Senate bills we had introduced that also dealt with education service districts. So that brings us to the bill that's presently before you, and I'd be pleased to answer any questions about any of that.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Greg, would you go back to the bargaining issue? My concentration was broken there for a moment as you did it.
It was a rather heated discussion in both the 93 session and the 90 and subsequent sessions as to who was going to pay for this. And I think it's safe to say that the unions argued that the school district ought to pay for it. Again, the department was never a player in that because we knew we wouldn't pay for it one way or another, that we would just collect the fees to run the program. I think the position of the union was, though, that employees ought to be all treated the same. They didn't want to be treated differently from other employees that were subject to fingerprinting. The legislature did do that, and it decided that it would leave the issue of who pays up to collective bargaining. The statute itself says the employees will pay. It also provided for a schedule of payments for employees that did not or could not pay $42 out of one paycheck. Again, it was not an issue for us because we collect by simply taking it out of the state school fund support that goes to the districts. That was probably the only controversial part. I think it was who pays.
Thank you.
Further questions?
Would you go back to the exclusion of the SEAP?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, that was occurred in 1995, and again, there were two bills. The first bill to pass both houses and to become law was House Bill 2123. And that was a bill that we had asked for that would include in the definition of school districts so that the employees would be printed. It would include the state schools, the school for the deaf, and the school for the blind, and the training school. And what that bill said was that a school district includes deaf school, blind school, the training schools, and a school district as defined in ORS 330.003. At the time that this bill became law, ORS 330.003 included school district and education service district. Another bill considered during the same session, Senate Bill 262, which dealt not with fingerprinting but with reorganizing of ESDs, changed that definition again. And what it said was that a school district would include schools, common junior high schools, elementary districts, and it would include education service districts that collected taxes for their component districts, but it would not include other education districts. So you had a conflict between those two definitions by bills, two bills passed during the same session. The conflict was not discovered during that session, and indeed, as I indicated, it was not brought to our attention until this session. But the latter enacted bill was Senate Bill 262, which contained the definition that did not include non-equalization ESDs. There are only two ESDs that collect taxes in their component districts now. So the other 19 ESDs do not.
So the other 19 are what we're discussing today?
The other 19 are what we're discussing, that's correct.
Question, because in collective bargaining, then the other 19 were not a part of that discussion either?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, because everyone believed that all the ESDs were included, all employees of all ESDs were treated the same. They were all fingerprinted, and depending on the collective bargaining agreements that each employee had, they either paid for it or it was paid for by the ESD, again, depending on the collective bargaining agreement. And Mr. Green maybe can tell us more about that. And I don't know if he would know which ESDs were included in this or not.
Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green representing the Oregon School Boards Association. You did not hear from us originally on this bill. We supported the bill as it was originally placed before the committee. What I'm here today to talk about are the Dash A2 amendments. That would make ESD employees not on the same level as other employees in ESDs or school districts, which would basically say, ESDs, you have to pay for the fingerprinting costs. It may not sound like a great deal of money, $42.50, I believe, is the fee they're currently charging. Some of that goes to the Department of Ed, some of it goes to the state police, and some of it goes to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Policy decision was made in 1993. We want to be sure that folks that are close to our kids are not folks that have committed a certain list of crimes. And those list of crimes are enumerated in ORS 342-143. They are the most heinous of crimes you can think about against children. That was the issue, was safety of our children. With regard to fingerprinting, I think Mr. McMurdo has discussed it pretty well. There was no debate over the issue of whether folks were going to be fingerprinted or not. It was an issue of who would pay for the cost of the fingerprinting. We argued that that's an issue of collective bargaining decided at the local level, and it was going to be a cost to school districts if you put that cost onto them. We have school districts across the state. I prepared a testimony last session on this issue, and I can't remember the number of districts off the top of my head right now that pay it. And they pay it originally because the State Department of Education takes it off the top of the state school fund distribution to them. Some school districts, because of budgetary concerns and ESDs as well, charge their employees for that. We left a provision in the law that said if we do charge the employees, that they all they have to do is request from the school district and we'll take it out over a time period. So that it wasn't $42.50 out of one paycheck, because some classified employees may not work as many hours as other individuals in the school district. So if they request that it be taken out over a time period, the school district or ESD has to do that. What the Dash 2 would say is for ESD employees or classified employees, we're going to treat you differently than certified employees or classified employees in a school district. What we have now is everybody collectively bargaining it. This would say for ESD employees and those 19 ESDs, no, ESD will pay for it. And what we've always discussed on this issue is parity, that we treat employees the same, and that's an issue of collective bargaining. The other thing that this amendment does, as I just received it, is in Section 3, lines 14 through 18, it would require ESDs to reimburse employees who may have paid for fingerprinting since 1995. We don't know the number of employees we're talking about, but I would assume it's a pretty large number of folks. And what that would mean to ESDs is, in addition to having to pay for any new employee that would be fingerprinted, any employee that they fingerprinted since 1995, classified employee, upon a request by that employee, we would have to reimburse them. Again, creating a different class of folks within the area of fingerprinting. The issue is safety for kids, and the issue of who pays for it is a bottom-line budget area. And some school districts do pay for it. Some ESDs do pay for it. But if they can't pay for it, that's an issue of collective bargaining, and it's been worked out at the bargaining table. This afternoon, I was speaking to Len Federico, who's the superintendent of the Willamette ESD, covering Marion and Polk counties. I said, Len, what do you do? And he said, well, we pay for it, but then we seek reimbursement from the employee, and we do it over a five-month time period. And the reason that Mr. Federico said is because they're an ESD who are below the equity level at ESDs, and we're dealing with that issue of ESD equity. I'm sure you're all aware of that debate if you've talked to your ESD folks. But they just simply cannot afford to pay for it. They do seek reimbursement from their employee, and they do it over a period of time. And it's an issue that they've worked out in their collective bargaining agreement where we believe it should be left to. Those are budgetary decisions that need to be decided at the local level and at the collective bargaining table. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
First of all ESD employees are only those who have contact with kids?
Only those ESD employees under ESD policy who have direct, unsupervised contact with students. And that's decided on an ESD and school district by school district basis. Because we do have many employees who may not have that indirect supervision.
One other question, how many new people would that involve a year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, I can't answer that because, you know, we have 198 school districts that determine by policy which employees may have direct and supervised contact with students, and 21 ESDs who make that determination as well. I don't know the number that we're talking about.
But not a huge number, I would assume.
It would, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, it could depend on the type of school district or ESD you're talking about. This bill, this amendment deals specifically with ESDs, but your question, if it's broader than that, we don't know because school districts hire a variety of
ESDs.
Again, Mr. Chairman, Representative Morissette, we don't know because it's going to depend on, you know, turnover of staff, how many new hires are coming in, and which one of those new hires may fill a position that has direct, unsupervised contact with a student.
One of the other issues that came about in 1993 was who was going to determine who was covered by the fingerprint law. The law was drafted to say people that have direct, unsupervised contact with children. But the law also specifically said as determined by the school district, or in this case, an ESD. So the state was not put in a position of trying to determine what local employees might do. I might add that we're not affected, the department itself, as far as its employees, is not affected one way or another by this amendment. And for your information, we do pay the cost for our own employees.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The specific provision E in Section 3, Sub 7, Sub D, which adds an educational service district. The basic reason that this bill is before us is because that was omitted.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. In 1995, as I indicated, a second bill passed during the legislative session changed that definition to exclude ESDs that were not equalization ESDs. So it effectively excluded 19 ESDs.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So basically, what we've been doing for the last 4 years is charging people illegally for a service that we had statutorily no right to charge them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, that's correct. As I indicated, we didn't know that. It was indeed the state board adopted a rule that defined an education service district to include all education service districts, believing they had that authority. That's the reason you see in the bill the language that validates those, so that for a couple of reasons. One, to be honest, for purposes of any liability, but also so that if this bill passes, assuming the legislature believes it is good public policy that all school employees who have direct unsupervised contact with children have criminal background checks, this bill would validate all of the prior fingerprinting so it would not have to be done again.
And to make sure that, you know, we're not, I think everybody agrees with the issue of safety in the schools. I don't think that is an issue that we need to, you know, to talk about in this. And the purpose and intention of everything is for safety in the schools. My concern is also about an issue of fairness. An issue of fairness to people who have had to pay out money through an error on perhaps our part, the legislature, perhaps ESD's part, somebody else's part. But these are people that had basically, many of them at the lower end of the pay scales, and it seems to me to be a question of fairness there.
Sure, Representative Jensen, this would also protect those districts or hold them harmless that paid that amount for their employees so they would not have to repay it again. So it affects the districts and the employees both.
Representative Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on this fairness issue, if we were to adopt the A2 amendments, wouldn't the fairness dictate that we reimburse any school employee that has been charged for this background check?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you adopt the amendments, that's what I understand the A2 amendments would do.
This just deals with the ESP stuff. What about the rest of the school employees that may or may not have been charged?
Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, they were retired and still are. The only question, the only problem that we're seeking to solve with the bill are employees of education service districts and not equalization districts.
You're missing my point. The point is if we're talking about fairness, we have school employees out there that have paid for this out of their own pocket. They negotiated with their school district or no, or they did or they didn't, and they paid for it. If we're going to allow ESDs, if we adopt the A2s and allow ESDs not to, you know, have to pay for this or have the employees pay, out of fairness, I think we should amend the A2s to include the reimbursement of any school employee that's had to pay out of the pocket so that we're fair across the board.
Identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent classified school employees in ESDs, community colleges, Parks and Rec, and K-12 districts through Oregon School Employees Association. Representative Starr, when this issue has come before the legislature each session, OSCA classified members have come to the legislature and argued that while we support the idea of assuring that our children are safe in school, indeed not just our children, but all staff are safe in school, and background checks are an important part of that. However, the fairness issue is whether or not an employee who has worked in an ESD, in the case of this bill, an ESD for many years, should not only have to prove they're not a criminal, but pay to prove they're not a criminal. And in terms of fairness between ESDs and school districts, while it is true they are both in the realm of public education in Oregon, I would submit to you that they are different. They are not the same. They are no more the same than higher education is the same as community colleges. They're similar. They both provide educational opportunities for Oregonians, but they are not the same.
Let's give one more question here, Representative Winters.
Then I can.
Then you can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great. On the, let's get back to the illegal piece, those who paid to have the licensing done and they really didn't have to. And I want to get back at the fairness issue. Are we going to require them to retake the fingerprinting? Do they have to do it over if it's on the file, even though it was done incorrectly? Do they have to do it again?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, no. There is a specific section in the A. Engrossed bill that validates any of the printing that was done without benefit of law and specifically says it doesn't have to be done again, no fees are going to be paid again, no applications. In other words, the answer is no.
So those who were fingerprinted, just so I understand, those who do have a file, fingerprint file, they don't have to retake it, so there's not any out-of-pocket money for that group.
That's correct.
So we're really talking about those who have not in those ESDs that haven't been fingerprinted.
We're talking about those who, in fact, have been fingerprinted. If you adopt the A2 amendment, they would be reimbursed.
I'm not going to reimburse for that. I'm trying to get the pool.
The pool would be those employees who are ESD employees, other than equalization ESD employees, that were fingerprinted after September 9, 1995, up until the effective date of this bill. There is provision in here says that they do not have to be printed again, they do not have to pay again, they will apply again, nor do school districts have to pay again.
Okay. So the population of Colorado that do not have CREST are the ones that are in the excluded ESDs that were never...
And future hires of
future hires, I...
Right.
I don't want to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Patricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I appreciate the committee discussing the -A2 amendment, which I requested. OSEA and its membership, as I said a moment ago, supports assuring as much as possible that our children are safe in school. And that includes proving that our members are not criminals that work in school. However, as I said earlier, we have always contended that were the legislature to require something similar of business, a private business, for example, they would likely assume that this requirement is the cost of doing business. If it is incumbent upon a business to assure safety, then it's incumbent upon the business to pay for the safety. And the same is true of school districts and ESDs. However, because at the time in 1993 and 95 and 97 that these issues came up for school districts, we were talking about tens of thousands of employees, tens of thousands. And the cost to school districts would have been huge had they been required to bear the entire cost. Classified employees wanted their employers to pay this $42 cost because when you're working for $10,000 a year, $42 is a bunch of money. Employers wanted classified employees to pay the cost because when you add up all those $42 charges, it's a bunch of money. The compromise the legislature came to in the case of school districts was collective bargaining so that those issues could be decided on a school district by school district basis. I would suggest to you that in the case of Senate Bill 367, we have a different issue before us. We understand from the department that the numbers of ESD employees who have not yet been fingerprinted is likely to be near zero. Most of these people have already been fingerprinted illegally in violation of their constitutional rights. They are not interested in taking ESDs or the departments or anyone else to court over that issue. They're willing to accept Senate Bill 367, which eliminates the liability for that illegal act. However, they don't believe that they should be required to pay $42 to prove to their employer that they've been working for a long time, to prove that they're not criminals and can continue to do their job. We think in the case of these employees, because their rights have been violated, admittedly, that the amendment is appropriate. It doesn't make up for the violation of their rights. It does, however, at least take away the pain of having to pay for that violation. The amendment does two things. It requires for those who have not been fingerprinted and would be required under the bill that the ESD pay the cost of that fingerprinting. $42. It also requires that for those employees that have been illegally fingerprinted, should they request reimbursement, that they be reimbursed. It does not require the districts to go back and figure out who they fingerprinted and track them down and find out where they are and give them $42. It requires that should that employee request reimbursement, that reimbursement be given. We believe this is purely a fairness issue. We think there is a lot of reason to support the -2 amendment. And again, this is ESD employees, not school district employees. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're still trying to get at some idea of how many employees and how much would it cost.
Representative Winters, I know how many employees, or I can tell you the number of employees that have, ESD employees, that have been fingerprinted since the act itself was enacted, but I cannot tell you how many were fingerprinted after September, from the facts I have, after the effective date of the law that changed the definition. So I don't know that I can give you a number that you're going to feel comfortable with.
Plus, Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, this amendment does two things. It says not only will we recoup costs for those folks who may have been fingerprinted since September 9, 1995, but it also says for those folks who may be hired by an ESD into the future, if they're decided by the ESD to have direct unsupervised contact with students, the ESD shall pay for their fingerprinting. And that, while Ms. Smith may say is an issue of fairness, issue of parity, because then you're going to create this special class of employees in the school environment. And they would be treated differently than a school district classified employee or an ESD certified employee or a school district certified employee.
Mr. Chair, if I could perhaps offer an amendment to what my colleague just said, that is not the only parity issue, is in whether or not it's bargained at the bargaining table. There is no parity issue in who pays, because for school district employees, as Mr. Green indicated, some do, some don't. So for his argument to pan out, we're talking about whether or not it's a collective bargaining issue. As I said earlier, it was became a collective bargaining issue for school district employees because we were talking literally about tens of thousands of people times 42 bucks, and that was a bigger chunk than the legislature could bite off all at one time, and we appreciated that. Now we're talking about a handful of employees or a different group of employers, and it's a different situation.
Define handful.
I'd love to define handful. Wouldn't I just love to define handful? I can give you my piece of the handful. OSEA represents of the 19 school districts, or ESDs, 5 of those 19. Of those 5 ESDs, a total of 320 people are in the classified bargaining unit, total. Of that 320 people in those 5 ESDs, this is the part I can't get to. I can only get to a handful, again, as my term, of those who've actually who would actually fall under this bill, because most agency classified employees do not have contact with students. Most of them work in the offices, in the ESD, they take care of the ESD building. There are folks like that. So we're not talking about a huge number of people at all.
Well, we only need 1,177 to get to $50,000.
Yes.
And it's somebody else's.
Chair, I'd like a question of Cindy.
Right, let me get to the rest of the questions here. Representative Knoll, you have a question?
Yeah, actually I do. Thank you, Chair. Jim, I guess my concern is if, as you say, we're going to create a special class or a class that's going to be treated differently. Are you basically then arguing that every bargaining unit from here on out is going to come back and point to what you're saying is a special class and say, well, we deserve the same treatment as them, therefore you, Mr. School District, should be paying for our fingerprinting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Canope, I can't say what's going to happen at the bargaining table, but that may happen. And you know, while we're talking about a handful of folks that may have been fingerprinted since September 9, 1995, we are talking about into the future hires. And we don't know that number for those 19 ESDs into the future as to how many folks we're talking about there.
Yeah, I have another question. Tricia, my ESD district, as you probably know, is the lowest in terms of equity. And I guess my biggest concern is what if I voted to adopt the A2 amendments, what kind of a bill am I going to hand to these folks, and is that going to affect potentially programs that are already existing? And I have yet to hear anybody give me an answer that I'm comfortable with. I mean, are we going to be able to get any closer than we have, or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Canope, as I indicated, we don't have a breakout. I can give you the number of ESD employees, including employees that are not affected by this. It gets so complicated. That are not affected by this bill, and ESD employees that were newly hired employees before the definition problem on September 9th, 1995, classified, excuse me, and that would be 6,128. But I do not know, again, how many of those would not have been printed anyway. We don't, I don't have the way, the means of doing that. And it would not be that many, but the number is in the thousands, so I think would be covered by this bill.
Tricia, actually ask you a question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knoll, as I said before, I would love to be able to give you an accurate number. My union doesn't keep those records, and we have been unable to get them from the department. So we can't give you an actual number. I think 6,000 statewide, I don't know, in terms of those that have already been fingerprinted. I would just say again that any that have been fingerprinted in these 19 ESDs were fingerprinted in violation of the constitutional rights. And this bill does a couple of things. It goes back and requires the fingerprinting. It eliminates the liability for the violation of those employees' rights and folds their fingerprints into the database legally. So we've got a different kettle of fish for these employees, we believe, than we did 4 years ago when we were talking about school district employees. And $42 is a pretty easy payoff for a violation of constitutional rights, I think.
Jackie, you
have a question?
I'm sorry, that's that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's some discussion that the dash two amendment, if passed, would have a payout on collective bargaining, that this issue really is a collective bargaining issue. And I'd like for you to clarify that.
For the record, Cindy Hunt, Legislative Council's Office, Mr. Chair, Representative Winters. What the amendments do is, if you have the A2s in front of you, you'll notice that you need to read it pretty carefully because it only applies to existing employees of education service districts. And an existing employee is one who's employed on the effective date of the act, or one who was employed between September 9th, 1995, and the effective date of the act. So it's only those employees who they could not recover costs for doing the fingerprint check, or who could get reimbursed if they did pay. Now, if someone is not within this definition of existing employee, it is still a collective bargaining issue because the original statute applies. And then that leaves it up to the local ESC.
So the window has been narrowed to that period of time.
Right.
When the ESDs were excluded. Is that
correct?
Yeah. Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen.
Thank you. And here. And I thought I heard Mr. Green saying that future ESD employees would be getting an advantage that other school district employees would not be getting. And what I hear you saying is that's not true. They'd be in the same category as other school district
employees. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, they if they fit the definition of existing employee of an ESD as it's laid out in these amendments, then they're in a different category. But if they're not currently an education service district employee, then they would be in the same category as other school districts.
That is future employees.
Correct.
Don't fit this category. Somebody hired after the effective date of this. And so they would be treated just like somebody who goes to work at the local school.
Right. Right.
Any other questions? Thank you. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3, or correction, Senate Bill 367. We're going to come back to this on Monday. So, Mr. Chair, we'll put that. Give us some time to. Maybe we just got those dash ones and also do some inquiry. we will go into a work session on Senate Bill 487, and council has an update and then some new information on insurance the committee asked for.
Senate Bill 487A requires a proof of school attendance or other educational progress before the Oregon Department of Transportation may issue a driver's license to a person under the age of 18. That proof may come in a variety of forms that are listed here. The new information that I have for you since we last heard this bill has to do with insurance rates and the effect of the potential effect on insurance rates in the event that a student were to lose his or her driver's license for non-attendance at school, and then when they regain their driver's license, what has happened to their insurance rates. The information that I have is that in some cases, a student whose license had been suspended under this act and was later reinstated might experience an increase of insurance premiums. That's if the student had been in a preferred risk classification and had then lost that status due to the suspension. Talking to some insurance companies, I am advised that there would be very few students who are in a preferred risk classification, but I have other companies that tell me no. In their case, they have really quite a few students who have that. So I think we need to be aware that in what could be a number of cases, a student might experience a negative impact on their insurance rates if they were to go through this cycle.
Just a question of Mr. Fox on that. In the preferred risk category, would it maybe be more likely that they would be insured under their parents' insurance policy and the parents on an insured risk, and the parents' insurance policy then might be placed in some jeopardy on that?
One of the companies that I spoke with indicated that they would, in this kind of situation, would make certain that, you know, that the parent was not necessarily penalized, that the rate for the student would be affected without it affecting the rate for those parents. Now, they said, of course, it's you know, it's up to each family exactly who's really going to be paying that, but that they would make a distinction between the student's rate and the overall rate the family was paying.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Norma. That is very consistent with the information that I received when I talked to my insurance agent about this issue. So I think it's something, and I think, as I said in the last meeting, I don't know whether this is or is not something that should alter our decision, but it's something I think we need to be aware of before we make that decision. So I really appreciate the staff's providing that information for us.
Any further comments? We are in a work session with Representative Close.
I believe I'm going to vote against this bill, and I want you to understand why. You said that driving is a privilege, not a right. I feel in our society that it's not a privilege. It is the ability to make a living. And I don't believe that we should be taking away a person's right to make a living or their decision on what they're going to do with their future. I think this is the parent's decision that they should make with their child, and it is not the government's decision. And if you do this with a driver's license, I believe, then you take away their ability to work. So I'm going to close it.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also am going to oppose this a little bit for the same reasons that Representative Close said, but also in addition to that, I think it's an exercise in futility. The young person goes to the Department of Motor Vehicles and picks up a form. He or she then takes it to the high school or to the district office, wherever, and gets it signed if they're in school. They then drop out of school, never attend again, and then the meat and the teeth of the law become totally lax and gone, because if you remember, the 10-day taking the license away is optional. It's not mandatory. therefore, the one part that probably could have maybe drug kids back to school, although I'm not sure I'm for that, isn't even operational. It's an optional part of it. So, and also, I don't think the whole thing will have any impact on keeping kids in school, so I will vote against it, too.
Other comments? Representative Winters.
Thank you. I guess I look at it a little different than my colleagues, because I look at it as a tool for keeping young people in school. And if this will assist, then I think all that we can do to keep our young, energetic individuals. We heard testimony from students who have now become young adults who said that they, even though they didn't like the bill, they thought it would be helpful. And they thought it was another tool that we should use. So that's just not good.
Representative Jensen, further comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with all respect to my two colleagues who expressed some opposition to the bill, I think I'm going to support the bill. I know of only one thing that's a more powerful influence on a young person than their right to drive a car. And if there's anything we can do to keep kids in school, you know, education is the best welfare reform that we have. Education is the best juvenile crime prevention. Education is the best crime prevention that we have. Anything we can do to help kids stay there, I'm all for doing.
Representative Morissette.
Well, I would move Senate Bill 478 to the floor to be passed recommendation, and, because I agree with I think it's a tremendous tool. I mean, having taught high school for a number of years, I know how important it is to young people who does. And you take that right away, and they're going to be 99% of the otherwise wouldn't.
Okay. Representative Morissette moves Senate Bill 487 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion, Representative Canoe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would agree with the good representative and leader of the Independent Caucus. I think we heard in testimony from Senator Courtney that, in fact, although the new laws aren't uniform from state to state, that this has, in fact, had an impact on dropout rates. And according to testimony, the financial impact of this is fairly minimal. And I think if we could find a way to keep kids in school and keep them from dropping out, if we actually knew of a way, I think we would spend millions, if not tens of millions of dollars to do it. Yet this is a $64,000 question, because apparently that's about what it's going to cost. So I'm willing to give this a try, because I think it's important enough that we make an effort to do this, and since this has worked in other states, I'm willing to give it a try. So I'm going to vote for the measure.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote against this. I put a note on my on this bill some time back. Freedom of movement, and I have a real difficult time with the freedom of movement being controlled through what I consider punitive means, and for that reason, I'm going to vote no. You know, I think this is another one of those Band-Aid things. I have no doubt this may have some effect, but I don't think it asks the question, why are our children dropping out? And I think we would do well to spend more time trying to figure that out than trying to come up with a series, as I've seen in this legislature, of temporary Band-Aid approaches that really mask going after the real problems.
Representative Beck, you're up to speed.
I indicated I would vote for it. I do have concerns, but in deference to Bill Nato, late Bill Nato, in my last conversation with him before I knew he was sick, or he knew he was sick in Portland, was
we need to not let kids have driver's license so young.
So it doesn't quite solve his problem, but it will be a deterrent, perhaps.
Okay. Well, I have not polled the committee, so this is up or down. I left that to the good senator from Salem, Kaiser. So clerk will call the roll.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Representative Close.
Nay.
Representative Hobson.
No.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Aye.
Representative Morissette.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Wilson.
No.
Representative Winters.
Aye.
Representative Ferris.
Chair votes, aye, the motion is passed.
Did the gavel go down first there?
I'm not sure.
Very excuse.
Representative Beck will carry that.
No way. I don't believe that. Who's sponsored it?
Your friend.
I'll do it for him if he needs to. Better ride a speed.
We will close the session on Senate Bill 487 and go into a public hearing on SJR 12. Charlie Williamson, Barbara Tomlin, and Ray Broyles. Oh.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Charles Williamson. I'm an attorney and a lobbyist from Portland, representing the Association for Children with Learning Disabilities. This measure started in 1997 in the Senate, where the ACLD attempted to have a bill passed, which many other states do have, which place a maximum limit on the caseloads of special education teachers. We found in Oregon caseloads of 50 or more in the elementary grades and 90 or so in some schools in the high school levels. We're not able to get, because of the cost and the unfunded mandate argument, we weren't able to get that passed in 1997, and we'd like to have the issue addressed. We'd like to keep the issue before you and folks at the local level. We will address it at the local level, but we thought a resolution recognizing the problem that we could take to the local level would help. And that's what SJR 12 is. The folks that opposed it last time have not. They say this is fine with them. I guess COSA hasn't said it's fine with them, but the School Board Association, the OEA, there has been no opposition to it. And so we would very much appreciate your committee's support. With me today is Barbara Tomlin and Ray Broyles, who can give you some more specifics.
Barbara, would you comment also on the Dash 1 amendments?
I haven't seen them. We did in a discussion with Mr. Fox last before the last hearing, which could take place because of the floor session. We did discuss possibly trying to get some more information and get some final or some more statistics on what the caseloads are, taking into consideration the various variables which could apply, and perhaps have the Department of Education do a sample study to test this. And we're very much in favor of that. We'd like to see, and I think there are other efforts as well going on to try and quantify what happens to the double weighting money, and I think in 2 or 4 years we may have some more information on that, but we very much support the Dash 1 amendments as well.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm somewhat shocked at the request for 25 students for special education teachers. And I'm somewhat shocked that the states listed above that are in the bill that currently have this. I look especially at the state of Iowa that recently went to 17 students in the regular classroom and 25 in special education classrooms. I'm perplexed at that. And what is the load in the state around it?
In Oregon, it varies. It even varies within the same school district. But as we've said, in some situations, it's up to 90, some over 100, we've heard. It's not classrooms, though. It's case loads. I mean, the kids are in the class, in regular classes. They're then also instructed by the special ed teachers separately. The special ed teachers have to do reams of paperwork putting together the IEP, the individual education programs for them. They're also charged with trying to identify who is in need of what other learning disabled students there are. So they have a tremendous job, and many of them are leaving the profession because they can't do anything except paperwork. They don't feel they're helping students. They're overworked, and we have some evidence of that today as well. The 25, we're not asking, this bill doesn't impose a 25. It just says when you're doing your budgeting, when you're doing your collective bargaining, just look at it and think about it and pay some attention to it.
Oh, Representative Hobson.
Well, I wasn't sure. Do you want us to wait? Or?
Why don't we finish the testimony? Maybe we'll get some questions answered, then we can.
For the record, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Barbara Tomlin. I'm from Wilsonville. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm the mother of two wonderful children with learning disabilities, and I'm here to speak on behalf of this bill. Being a special educator is one of the toughest jobs in the world. One teacher I know starts her day at 5:30 in the morning. At 7:30, she's busy working on CAS meetings. She works all day with the kids. She does an incredible amount of paperwork. She takes some of it home with her at night because she has to call parents. Often that's the only time she can get a hold of parents. This particular teacher has to attend 3 meetings next week on transition. As you probably know, by the age of 14 now, it's mandated that transition meetings will take place. Another teacher I know is working at a middle school in the Westland Wilsonville district, is quitting this year at the end of the year. This teacher is not going into regular education where she would be ideally suited because she's too burnt out. She's part of a statistic and a disturbing trend at a time when we are critically short of special education teachers. You see, special educators wear many hats. They're not just teachers. They deal with paperwork. They deal with they're almost social workers often helping kids. They are also case managers, and ideally they also converse with parents at least once a week or at least once a month. It's because a lot of parents have questions about where their child is in special ed. There is a higher number of kids who not only have one disability but might have multiple disabilities. So the special educator also has to deal with ancillary service people, maybe a speech pathologist or a physical or occupational therapist, to effectively meet the needs of kids who have maybe more than one disability. Not all special ed kids are low ability. Einstein and Thomas Edison had learning disabilities. Do we have the right to deny a future Thomas Edison or Einstein the chance of an education that would meet his needs? Alternatively, is it cheaper to have a special education child drop out, get arrested, do drugs, or to have them graduate and be a productive member of our society? These kids need education that is a little bit different than most regular ed kids. They're often very bright. It has nothing to do with mental ability. It has to do with being learning different and need a different way of instruction. If our teachers are burdened with too much paperwork, they can't help the kids. They can't be there for the kids. The choice is up to us to provide an education that meets their needs by providing educators who have the time to do so. Please vote in favor of caseload limits. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Ray Broyles, and I'm from Portland with the Oregon Association for Children and Adults with Learning Disabilities. I've been in special education for over 30 years, and I've seen some things change, not necessarily for the better. And that's why we're urging the words consideration be given by the school district and others in regard to the numbers. One of the things I do is spend a lot of time working with parents throughout the state. And they always comment about the time frames, the lack of services, the personnel able to work with their kids. I've been with the David Douglas School District, the Union County Educational Service District, and the St. Helens School District. And this is something that's echoed throughout the state. So we urge you to take some time so that the school districts and personnel that are involved with special need kids take one more look at the consideration of time and talents working with them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the initial introduction, I wasn't quite clear. Did you say OEA does or does not support this?
They support it.
And OSBA?
I understand they support it as well.
And COSA?
COSA, I think, sees it as a camel's nose under the tent, and they're afraid that there'll be some sort of mandatory bill down the road, and so they have not, they haven't opposed it, but I don't, they haven't, they said they don't support it.
Okay, and a second question, if I might.
We don't need to have COSA come and test it.
I'm a little unclear. Is this an attorney or a law firm that is representing this organization, or I'm not clear the...
I'm sorry, that is... My law firm.
So the law firm represents this organization?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Steve Johnson and Wilma Wells.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Johnson. I'm the Associate Superintendent for the Office of Special Education, Oregon Department of Education. I'm here today to indicate our support for this resolution with the Dash 1 amendments. We believe that the information that is requested in the statistical study is needed information and that it would result in providing guidance for parents, for teachers, and school districts throughout the state. The goal of special education, along with all of education, is to provide effective instruction and services for students to assure their success, and we believe that this information would give us additional data to make good decisions for the education of students with disabilities. In order to conduct the study, we would propose that we would work with teachers, with parents, with administrators, and other interested parties to assure that the study addresses the questions of all involved. I do want to clarify, however, some of our concern with the language in the resolution, and we believe that the resolution itself may contain some overgeneralization that is not true in all cases. It is not true, in fact, that all teachers have an excessive caseload. I have visited many teachers whose caseloads are 6 or 10 or 12 children per classroom. At the same time, I will acknowledge that I have conversed with teachers who do have large caseloads of 50 or 60 students. These teachers also identify for me that they work with instructional assistants, sometimes 4, 5, or 6 additional personnel who provide services to students, resulting in an adult student ratio of 1 adult to every 5 students. I do appreciate the demands that are made on teachers. Their special education teachers are called to consult not only with parents and with agency personnel outside the school, but frequently spend much of their time working with general education staff. It is in that spirit I also object to the language that teachers are unable to deliver quality education and instruction. I'm sure that the Association for Children with Learning Disabilities would agree with me that teachers are very able to provide instruction. They are well trained, they are committed, and they're dedicated to ensuring that students with disabilities do succeed. I would also be concerned with the overgeneralization that children and families are suffering because of a lack of instruction. I do believe that in some unfortunate cases, that may be the case. But overall, our monitoring efforts, Our efforts to ensure compliance with federal and state requirements do indicate that parents and children are receiving the services that they do require and, in the great main, are very satisfied with those services. As we conduct the study, I do enter into it with a concern that formulas themselves can create a ceiling that all districts will strive to achieve. The classrooms that currently have 6 or 8 children being served because of their intensive needs may find themselves swelling to 25 as a formula is applied across the board. I would look for the information that would be resulting in the preliminary report to guide our decision-making in that area. We are willing and eager to do this development and study, recognizing the additional demands on our resources, but we do consider this a high-priority issue. Student achievement is our purpose. This information is needed to improve the decision-making and to support effective instruction for students with disabilities and for their success. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm Wilma Wells, for the record, and I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I'll point out to you again that I'm a former teacher, that I'm within 3 hours of a certificate in special education, that I supervised special education programs when I was a principal in the Salem District, both preschool and regular, and both for children who were severely handicapped and those who were learning disabled or simply had a speech problem. And I'm not worried about camel's noses with due respect to the prior testifier. I don't care for some of the language. I see the bill as having a good purpose. They want to encourage lower class loads for special ed teachers. And I can't quarrel with the idea that there's too much paperwork. Unfortunately, we can't control this. I think I've told you before what they do in Washington, although we have, in fact, tried and sent delegations to Washington and to our congregational representatives and also to the committee members who were working on it, particularly the new special ed bill. We were not successful, and there's more paperwork now than there was before. I have a niece who's a special ed teacher. She teaches in Lane County. She teaches in a primary school. She has 24 students assigned to her, and as with most special education teachers, she works with groups of children at a time, sometimes 2 or 3, sometimes 4 or 5, sometimes 1, depending upon what the children's particular needs are. In some of our classes, as Steve has already pointed out to you, we have 12 students with 3 aides and a teacher because the students' needs are so intense. In fact, there was one in Dallas a few years ago where there were 10 students and one teacher and 3 teacher aides. And if you're at high school, some of these people with a high class load are, for the most part, doing the paperwork and consulting with teachers. Ideal situation, but I'm not the superintendent there, nor am I the chair of the board. We don't object to the bill. I don't care for all of the language. Nothing in this world that I know of is.
Ms. Johnson, would you work with the committee administrators to give us some dash twos to clarify or to tighten up the oversimplification, the overgeneralized portion?
Sure, I'd be happy.
Okay, why don't we do that, and then what we'll do is bring this back one day for a work session and look at those amendments that you need.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we're going to be looking at amendments, I have a very serious concern about the language that was brought forward here. I think we have some real liability issues if we are putting out there the fact that we agree that there's an inability to deliver quality education, and we're saying that children with disabilities and their families have suffered. I think we're opening ourselves up to very serious litigation, and having dealt with a number of special ed type cases where it did involve litigation, I think it needs to be much, much safer and clearer. So I concur with fixing that language.
Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 12. Thank you.
Let's see, for the committee's information, we had House Bill 3307. That was the PE bill, if you remember, recall that bill. And we passed that bill out with two dissenting votes, and it somehow, as we passed the dash four amendments, in the printing, collected the dash two amendments, and those were printed into the bill. So when that bill gets to the floor, we're going to refer it back to the committee so that we can correct it as we pass it out of the committee and then send it back again. So just so you know that that's coming. Let's see. And don't forget the you've been asked to fill out some evaluations, if you'll do those. And then we have been so diligent and worked so hard that we are on top of our workload, and we will not meet on Friday.
Oh, you're a star.
So,
my hero. Yeah.
All that hard work that we did, and we stayed late a few days, really just paid off.
Could we ask that we spend that time on the floor instead?
That's not good. Ideal.
Mr. Chair, weren't you going to have a book reading of your book on Friday? What's that?
I forgot that. You know what?
Mr. Beck, starting with chapter one.
We're adjourned. Signed copy.